a distinct pleasure to be able to introduce a speaker who in some ways represents for us a change of pace, in that our lecture is related primarily to the world of art. Born in Bielefeld in West Germany, she has studied in a number of universities, including Stanford University, from which she received her doctoral degree, Tulane University, and the Sorbonne. She has done extensive work in organizing exhibits at various museums. Her most recent connection with Washington, D.C., consisted of her serving as a senior fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Visual Arts at the National Gallery of Art. She is currently a professor of art history at Columbia University, and as of January, will be a guest scholar at the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles, California. She has concentrated most of her work so far on an artist by the drawings of Urs Grau. She has also prepared a number of catalogs for exhibitions, and there's one exhibition in particular to which I'd like to draw your attention, for which she was responsible, namely for an exhibition entitled From a Mighty Fortress, Prints and Drawings in the Age of Luther from the Festive Coburg Collections at the Detroit Institute of Art and the National Gallery of Canada, Ottawa, and Kunstsammlungen der Festive Coburg, 1981-82. It is with distinct pleasure that I present Christiane Andersen.
Thank you very much, Professor Lehman, and thank you all of you for having me here. I'd like to begin by having the lights down, please, and to ask Gary to give us the first two slides, please. As you gather, it's very difficult to project slides in so large a room. We have a little difficulty in that at the angle where I am to the two screens, I can't see whether they're focused at all. And the other thing is that my very competent projectionist in the back of the room also can't see them from where he's standing. So I would be very grateful to the people who were sitting at tables 8 and 9 to kindly let me know when you need a focus job, either left or right. And please bear with me. May I have the volume turned up, please? On this momentous occasion, it seems appropriate to consider the means Martin Luther and his fellow evangelical theologians had at their disposal to disseminate the newly reformed faith. Much has been written about Luther's astute use of the printed word, and yesterday evening we had the pleasure of hearing Lutheran music, whose texts and melodies were of course also recorded and made known throughout Europe by printed editions. The major disadvantage of propagating the new faith via printed texts, however, is obvious. In the early years of the Reformation, the vast majority of the German population was illiterate. Engelsing estimates that the literacy rate may have been between 10 and 30% in German towns, but nationally it was probably no higher than 5%. Thus, Luther had to rely on pictures and on the oral transmission of his theology. Oral history is a complex matter, the study of which I prefer to leave to social historians better equipped than I. But the visual evidence of how Lutheran ideas were spread has come down to us in great abundance, and this is the subject I would like to address this afternoon. Luther Baker, of course, actively exploited the availability of woodcut images, usually in conjunction with the printed text. He certainly realized the dual importance of text and image, produced in the form of broadsheets and pamphlets, which could be read aloud by those who could read to those who could not, and whose trenchant images were, of course, accessible to everyone. As in any issue where so much is at stake, the verbal and visual rhetoric quickly took on a highly polemical tone, and it is a selection of such politically weighted statements that I'd like to show you today. Broadsheets, which of course existed well before the Reformation, are an early form of mass communication in which a letterpress text and a woodcut image were printed together on a single sheet of paper, as you see, for example, on the left screen. When the text was somewhat longer and hence occupied several pages, the sheets were loosely bound together in a pamphlet, as you see on the right screen, with the woodcut image usually appearing as the title page illustration. In general, broadsheets differ from pamphlets only in the length of the text and in the number and arrangement of sheets of paper bearing the text and the image. Among the most popular and effective of the themes illustrated and commented upon in broadsheets prior to the Reformation were unnatural or fearful events, such as misbirths, strange celestial formations, pestilence, bad weather, floods, and the like. In a highly superstitious, pre-scientific age, such incidents took on supernatural significance in the popular imagination and were interpreted as omens and portents of divine displeasure over the sinful deeds of mankind. Owing to the great confusion and irrational fears which they inspired in common folk, such omens lent themselves well to political exploitation. German publicists were quick to capitalize on this polemical potential. Their diatribes, published in the form of broadsheets and pamphlets, had an especially profound effect during two critical periods when the imminent end of the prevailing social structure and even of the world itself had been predicted, as occurred for the years 1500 and 1524. The two broadsheets on the screen, issued prior to these dire events, demonstrate the atmosphere of catastrophe. On the left, the falling of a large meteor on the Alsatian town of Enzisheim in 1492 was described and given a political interpretation by Sebastian Brandt, the famous publicist and author of The Ship of Fools, who transformed a natural event into a divine reprimand against current imperial policies in Germany. On the right screen, a pamphlet of 1523 predicts torrential rains in the following year, in 1524, therefore, which would eventually flood the entire world, similar to the biblical flood survived only by Noah and the animals. Among the many types of omens and disasters publicized in broadsheets, misbirths and monsters seem to have held a particular fascination for the German people. Very likely, they were the most common theme in broadsheets before the Reformation. One of the more imaginative ones is this example of 1512, belonging to the British Museum on the left screen, which reports the birth of Siamese twins named Elisabeth and Margarete. The illustration, printed on a separate sheet and pasted vertically onto the broadsheet between the columns of text, can be flipped over thereby allowing us to inspect these unfortunate creatures from the rear as well. It was in the service of the Protestant Reformation, however, that misbirths as a propaganda tool truly came into their own. all the later polemical examples produced in Nuremberg and other artistic centers in Germany were more or less directly indebted to the famous polemical pamphlet issued in 1523 by Luther and Melanchthon. Luther and Melanchthon were responsible for both the text and the configuration of the images. The woodcuts themselves were designed by Lucas Cranach the Younger. The pamphlet illustrated and commented polemically upon the two monsters you see before you, one a real misbirth, the other half legendary. On the right is the image of a calf born near Freiberg in Saxony in 1522, which came to be called the monk calf. On the left is a second woodcut of a fantasy creature allegedly discovered in the Tiber near Rome in 1496, called the papal ass. May the Pope forgive me. And the papal ass is illustrated in a second section of the same pamphlet. The woodcuts are elucidated by elaborate allegorical interpretations of the papal ass written by Melanchthon and of the monk calf composed by Luther. The papal ass on the left consists of an ass's head attached to a female torso with one human hand and an animal limb. Its legs end in a hoof and in a claw. It is almost entirely covered with scales, and its tail resembles that of a dragon. This curious image originated in Italy at the end of the 15th century and seems already then to have been associated with an anti-papal polemical campaign. The appearance of this monster, supposedly dredged out of the Tiber, as I said, in the 1480s, or early 1490s, had been publicized in Rome as a portent reflecting on the sinful deeds of Pope Alexander VI, as is evident from the buildings visible in the woodcut. The one flying the papal flag in the left background is the Castel Sant'Angelo, which Alexander had refurbished as a fortification, while the square tower to the right of the papal ass is probably the Torre di Nona, a structure across the Tiber which Alexander used as a papal prison. The appearance of the monster and of the two Roman structures was transmitted to Germany by this engraving by the Bohemian artist Wenzel von Olmütz, which our polemical woodcut closely copies. Olmütz's composition, in turn, must have been based on an Italian broadsheet circulated in Rome in 1496, but no impressions of this are known. Presumably, the Bohemian artist's engraving was connected with the Bohemian Brethren's opposition to the papacy. The monk calf on the right screen, shown here in a reversed copy from one of the numerous subsequent editions of this polemical tract, originated closer to home, in Luther's own province of Saxony. Because this freak of nature was born with a large flap of skin on its back resembling a cowl, and due to the bald spot on its head similar to a tonsure, its appearance offered obvious analogies to that of a monk. Hence, it became known as the monk calf. As illustrated in Luther's tract, the monk calf stretches one front leg out like a hand, a gesture which Luther understood as preaching. The extended tongue he saw as evidence that monkish teaching amounts to nothing more than idle gossip. And the flaps of skin resembling ears, he explained as signifying the tyranny of confession. This misbirth occurred in 1522 and led to at least two polemical interpretations criticizing the clergy prior to Luther's pamphlet, which appeared the following year. Thus, Luther was not the first to exploit the calf misbirth for polemical purposes, but his is certainly the definitive edition. By expressing their polemical message in terms of divine portents, Luther and Melanchthon, in essence, gave divine sanction to their theology. They cleverly captured the attention of a wide audience with the exploitation of omens, events which both fascinated and frightened the German population. As we have seen, neither the papal ass nor the monk calf was Luther's or Melanchthon's own invention, but of course effectiveness rather than originality was the primary consideration. Not only Lutheran theologians, but also publicists in the Catholic camp quickly realized that the widespread interest in omens guaranteed a mass audience for propaganda employing this type of imagery. Thus, the monsters and misbirths, which had been so familiar a part of popular culture before the Reformation, soon became one of the most common forms of polemical imagery used in support of theological issues or merely for character assassination. The polemical tradition in illustrations of misbirths, as devised by Luther and Melanchthon in Wittenberg, was quickly and eagerly embraced by artists and publishers throughout Germany. For instance, the broadsheet on the right screen, created by a Nuremberg artist who remains anonymous and published by Stefan Hammer in 1546, reports the alleged discovery of a misshapen fish with a human head washed ashore near Copenhagen. This is the impression at the British Museum that I'm showing you here on the right slide. In its fish-like characteristics, this bizarre creature is clearly a descendant of the scaly papal ass, which had been dredged out of the Tiber about 50 years earlier. But it recalls to mind the monk calf as well in its monk's habit and cowl. By 1546, the papal ass, the monk calf, and their ilk had spawned so great a variety of misbegotten monkish offspring that the satirical implications of such a figure must have been obvious. Hence, only a very brief explanatory text was necessary. An earlier work of about 1530, designed by the Nuremberg artist Erhard Schön, casts the monkish monster in the role of a musical instrument, here a bagpipe. The broadsheet satirizes how the Catholic clergy operate, through the power of the devil, in this instance, through the power of a demon's lungs. Although in the earlier literature this broadsheet has been interpreted as a satire on Luther, who of course also began his religious career as a tonsured monk, on the basis of the text below there can be no doubt that the polemical barb is directed at Catholic monks. The broadsheet was issued at Nuremberg in at least three versions, two of which you see before you. The earlier one on the left screen, here in the impression belonging to the Schlossmuseum in Gotha, bears eight lines of text printed at the lower right corner. In the later one at the right, shown in one of the impressions at the British Museum, the eight lines were omitted and substituted by a more extensive text arranged in three columns at the bottom of the sheet. In the Gotha text, the monk boasts that formerly simple Christian souls used to dance to any of his fantastic tunes, but he laments that now they no longer follow his lead. Pinning his hopes on the pervasiveness of human folly, however, he remains confident that his former deceitful power over the faithful can be restored. The text of the impression in London at the right recounts how the devil infiltrated all the monastic orders. Searching for an utterly unscrupulous cleric, he finally came across friar knows, as he is called here, and transforms him into his instrument through which he seduces and corrupts innocent souls. The choice of musical instrument is, of course, significant, since during this period, bagpipes were customarily associated with merrymaking, passion, and lust. The popular fascination with monsters, misbirths, and bizarre creatures of the sort we have just seen was not due to idle curiosity or sensationalism, as we might assume today, but rather to the religious convictions of the age. Nature was believed to reflect God's will. Being a perversion of God's creation, monsters and misbirths were the visible signs of sin in the world. The association of monsters with sin and the devil was used repeatedly by Protestant polemicists to reveal the demonic nature of the papacy and its supporters, cast in the guise of monsters. This process can be observed in the animal heads with which Luther's opponents appear in Reformation broadsheets and pamphlets. In the broadsheet at the right, the Pope and four Catholic theologians have been transformed into hybrid monsters, each one in a way appropriate to his name. The lion in the center is, of course, Pope Leo X. The cat is Thomas Mörner, the goat is Jerome Emser, the sow Johannes Eck, and the dog represents the Tübingen theologian Jakob Lemp. Several of the animal heads are actually puns on the names of the people illustrated, not surprisingly, since puns were as dear to Renaissance publicists as they are to the ad agencies of Madison Avenue today. That Pope Leo should be represented as a lion was, of course, inevitable. Mörner being shown as a cat is an onomatopoetic parody of his name, which in German suggests the sound of meowing. Likewise, Emser's animal head also derives from his name, which means goat. The other choices of animal associations are more vitriolic. Johannes Eck of Ingolstadt, shown holding an acorn, is likened to a sow nuzzling in the dirt in search of food. Lemp is shown as a growling dog wrangling over the bone he holds. This association is a reference to his querulous conduct and ultimate defeat in the Zurich disputation due to his poor knowledge of the Bible, as we are informed by the text printed below. Such hybrid monsters with animals' heads became the standard means of representing Luther's opponents in anti-papal propaganda. In the woodcut at the left, illustrating the title page of a pamphlet containing scathing denunciations of Luther's adversaries, we see again Leo the lion, the pig-snout Dr. Eck of Ingolstadt, the meowing Mörner, and the goat-headed Emser. They are assembled around a monk with an ass's head who plays a violin, a symbol revealing his worldly inclinations, and who tramples on scripture, displaying his contempt for God's word. At the left, we see a canon adorned with the large ears of a donkey, and hovering above this curious group is a swarm of insects, appropriately chosen to show that the protagonists all have a bee in their bonnet. In the broadsheets and pamphlets we have seen thus far, Protestant publicists employed allegorical and symbolic pictorial means to illustrate the transformation of their human opponents into demonic beasts, unmasking them, so to speak, to reveal their true nature. But they also devised an even more ingenious method whereby this metamorphosis could be made to occur mechanically before our very eyes by moving the woodcut to change the image. Broadsheets of this type functioned like the round vavels, which had long been used to illustrate the movement of the planets in astronomical treatises. This South German example of about 1535 shows the transformation of the Pope into a series of monsters. The image consists of two superimposed woodcuts attached in the center, one displaying the Pope's body and a background landscape, the other behind it bearing the interchangeable heads, only one of which is visible at a time in the wedge-shaped area at the top of the image. When the wedge is turned clockwise, the image changes sequentially, characterizing the Pope as a voracious cleric devouring an entire house, as the image of death, as a wolf in monk's garb, and finally as a ravening wolf consuming an innocent lamb. The ravening wolf attacking and devouring the flock, another of the most popular images devised by Reformation polemicists, is the theme of this Swiss trick woodcut, which demonstrates the metamorphosis of a Catholic friar by a foldover technique. Here, the image changes through movable flaps. We recall that a similar technique had already been used before the Reformation, as in the broadsheet describing the newborn Siamese twins, in which turning the woodcut over revealed a second one showing a different aspect of the same figure. Polemical woodcuts of the ravening wolf were, of course, based on the biblical parable of the Good Shepherd, the satirical analogy being frequently employed to castigate the Catholic hierarchy as ravening wolves menacing the flock of Christ. At first glance, the woodcut portrays a widow pleading with a monk for assistance for herself and her child. When the upper flap is lifted and folded back, the monk becomes a wolf devouring a lamb. Lifting another smaller flap transforms the image yet again, revealing the monk in the act of gobbling up the widow's entire house, which illustrates a passage from the Gospel of Matthew regarding the misdeeds of the Pharisees, which was printed atop the uppermost flap, that is, the one I showed you first, which is no longer now visible on the screen. The wholesale consumption of entire buildings visible here and in the previous trick woodcut castigating the Pope is, of course, an attack on the prebends which impoverished the German population. Prebends, or sinecures, were the stipends paid out of the estate of a church to its canons, who, according to the polemicists, collected them with evident greed, but often rendered few, if any, services to the congregation in return. The practice of prebends is virulently condemned in the pamphlets on the left screen, on which you see the title page woodcuts of two different editions. The ravenous nature of the Catholic hierarchy fleecing its congregation is literally expressed here as a canon devouring the very steeple of his own church, while the devil encourages his appetite. The slide at the left juxtaposes the original title page illustration with a copy made from it when the first woodblock wore out and required replacement. In the copy, the composition is reversed as a result of the reproductive process. Another pamphlet, The Song of the Wolves, Das Wolfsgesang, it's called, published in 1520, again casts the Pope and his entourage in the role of ravening wolves. However, in this instance, the title page illustrations show the wolves catching and fleecing geese rather than sheep. The prey are lured by music, then ensnared with nets, and finally robbed of their plumage and disemboweled by the two wolves wearing cardinal's hats who flank the papal wolf seated on his throne. The geese, duped and later devoured by a wolf, was a familiar image in the popular culture of early 16th century Germany. We encounter it primarily in popular proverbs of the day, in which the wolf preaches to the trusting geese and later devours them. The verbal image was occasionally transformed into a visual one, as you see in the German tapestry on the right screen. Predictably enough, the Lutherans applied the image of the preaching wolf to their papist opponents, giving a polemical twist to the popular proverb, which describes priests preaching like the wolf to the geese in the woods, meaning seeking to ensnare them by cunning. Our woodcut illustration alludes to this proverb, but for greater impact sets the stage at the papal court rather than in the woods, pointedly showing the Catholic clerics in the setting where they most seriously neglect their responsibilities as ordained men of God. The image conveyed in the proverb and shown in the tapestry has also been altered in the woodcut to demonstrate that the geese no longer even receive the benefits of preaching before being devoured. The broadsheets showing the Catholic clergy as wolves are calculated to reveal their ravenous appetite for German wealth and property. Perhaps the most drastic illustration of this idea is the title page woodcut illustrating Pamphilus Gengenbach's play The Devourers of the Dead, Die Totenfresser, published in 1522 and visible on the right screen. Here, however, the Pope and his entourage have regained their human form. Instead of wolves, we see the Pope, a bishop, a canon, a nun, and a monk's concubine seated around a table upon which a corpse is stretched out. The Pope carves up the carcass, while the monk next to him holds his hand over his nose and mouth to ward off the stench. This image of papist cannibalism is entirely appropriate to Gengenbach's argument in the play that by profiting from indulgences and from the services rendered to the dead and dying, such as requiems and absolutions, the Pope and the clergy feast on the dead. Not only do they exploit the dead for gain, they also offer no charity to the crippled beggar who appears in the left foreground. The anonymous artist who designed the woodcut, of course, chose this image of prelates feasting at table not only as an appropriate demonstration of cannibalism, but also as an allusion to another familiar image, that of drunkards and gluttons overindulging in food and drink. Well before the advent of the Lutheran Reformation, moralizing tracts warning of the dire consequences of such intemperance were illustrated with the type of popular image you see on the left screen. Couldn't resist showing you this image, which seems perhaps appropriate to the nature of our gathering this afternoon. This woodcut, taken from a pamphlet published in Strasbourg in 1489, shows the ill effects of excessive drink on young men who the text suggests should have more productive pastimes. A slightly later example, dated 1505, displays the standard components of such images of drunkards at table, in particular the vomiting drunk lying on the ground, whose issue is licked up by a dog. Good thing we've eaten. Subsequent versions of this popular image take an even more drastic attitude to the sin of overindulgence. The table has been overturned, the crockery broken, and the rowdy drunks have begun to fight. While Gengenbach's pamphlet, The Devourers of the Dead, at the right, formerly at the right, attacks papist exploitation of German property on an allegorical level, other polemical images accuse the clergy of drunkenness, gluttony, concupiscence, and worse. Peter Flöthner's travesty of a Catholic religious procession shows a merry band of thoroughly corrupt monks and nuns who are moving from a mass just said in the church at the left edge of the woodcut to the next one about to be said in the church at the right edge. Flöthner castigates the excessive numbers of masses, a manifestation of papist belief in the righteousness of good works. Instead of the usual church banners and crosses carried along in Catholic processions, a shish kebab of sausages and lanterns containing excrement to light the way, an image based on a popular proverb again, are held aloft. Rather than a chalice and the host, beer glasses, wine vessels, and roast fowl are in evidence. An open backgammon board replaces the large hymnal from which the officiating priest customarily... The hymnal is the one that's been replaced, from which normally the officiating priest would have sung the liturgy. The extent of the monk's self-indulgence is expressed in the two clerics overcome by vomiting and in the nun bringing up the rear who holds an illegitimate child in her arms. Those are our monks on the right side and this figure there. Illicit relations between the sexes are alluded to here by the two underpants held aloft on forked poles. Those there. In the 16th century, an exclusively male article of clothing, which symbolized manhood or male dominance in the household. Now, you may not have known this, but women didn't wear such things in the 16th century, and therefore this is an exclusively male attribute. It is the same garment shown in the foreground of Israel von Meckenem's engraving of a domestic squabble, which you see here at the right. This couple is fighting to determine, quite literally, who will wear the pants in the family. There you see it. I hope those of you in the back can see this. In a carnival play entitled Der Böse Rauch, perhaps freely translated as The Shrew, Hans Sachs stages a similar domestic battle, which is illustrated in the woodcut used in the title page for that play, as you see on the right screen. There it is. This time we have a black one instead of a white one there, and they're going at it. Now, Flöthner actually illustrates the German figure of speech hanging the breeches on a pole, which signified relinquishing male dominance to a woman. It is often shown as merely hanging the breeches on a peg instead of a pole. As we see in Thomas Mohrner's Geuchmatt, a humorous tract which describes, among other topics, Semiramis, the heroine clad in armor, pointing to the trousers hung up to symbolize her dominance over her mate. And there she is looking very proud indeed. And there is the trousers, the underpants on the peg. The monks in Flirtner's procession, therefore, have even given up their male privilege. And you can imagine how the 16th century interpreted that. Flirtner's rendering of the obese abbot, so rotund that he has to be carried from one mass to the next, borrows a topos from earlier satirical imagery, as expressed in this broadsheet satire on monastic intemperance on the right screen, which dates from the end of the 15th century. Now, the abbot is precisely in the middle of the image. I can barely see it from here, but it's, I think, there. Am I right? Good. An abbot so besotted that he cannot walk is shown reclining on a giant jawbone, a part of the anatomy aptly chosen to symbolize his weakness for imbibing. His precarious moral situation is emphasized by the locale. He's on very thin ice. I'm talking, of course, about the image at the right. The jawbone serves as a type of sled on which he is being pulled across a partially frozen lake by a group of nuns, while others similarly inebriated have already broken through the surface. As they sink ever deeper into the water, they plead with the nuns to give them one last drink. Hans Weiditz, the South German artist active in Strasbourg and Augsburg, revived the image after the Reformation in this broadsheet of about 1530 on the left. Weiditz simplified his prototype and exaggerated its satirical components for maximum effect. The abbot riding on the jawbone has gained in physical, though certainly not in moral, stature. The drinking vessel has grown in size and sloshes its contents about, and the partially submerged cleric in the foreground is only a cryptic gesture away from drowning. In conclusion, it seems evident from this brief survey of Reformation broadsheets and pamphlets that polemicists consistently base their visual rhetoric squarely in the pre-existing popular culture of early 16th century Germany, just as the texts consistently refer to scripture. Both text and image refer to a shared culture, which is both exploited and maintained by this type of mass communication. To the modern observer, they offer unusually vivid and fascinating glimpses into the daily concerns and changing attitudes of Lutheran polemicists and of the German people during the early Reformation era. This kind of information, expressed with equal immediacy, can be found elsewhere only in the far less accessible archival documents of the age. When the texts are examined within the historical context of the time, and the woodcuts explained on the basis of the culture they reflect, we gain fresh insight into the popular mentality of Luther's time. Thank you.